Hi, I'm Hedgeye's founder, Keith McCullough. Thanks for listening to this Real Conversation. If you like what you hear, you will love our investing research. We bring transparency, accountability, and actionable investing ideas to investors big and small. I'll put our investing process and team up against anyone in the world. Please visit Hedgeye.com to subscribe and learn a better way to invest. Hi, I'm Keith McCullough, and welcome back. It's time to flip a switch from Buddy Carter and all that practitioner stuff to the one and only Danielle DiMartino Booth. Thank you for making the time. Love having you on Hedgeye TV.
Great to be here, Keith, as always.
So what we have, did you say your twins just got into Culver Academy?
Yeah, it's my never, ever retirement plan.
They have a hockey team, don't they?
They have three traveling hockey teams, one of the best lacrosse programs in the country, great wrestling, football, but yeah. Nice. I drank the water. I drank the lake water. I bought a house up there. I hit the top of the housing market personally.
You're the second one to send your kids to military academy. We had Mike Green, it was yesterday, told us that his son committed to going to Navy. So well done.
Yeah, this is high school.
Yeah. Awesome.
I'm hardcore.
Well,
mean mom.
Well, congrats on that, Mom. That's cool. And it is amazing what you do every day. I mean, first of all, as a professional and certainly not the least of which is a mom. I mean, you get it done, and many, many people appreciate it. You grind every day. I like to think of us being part of the same community, because if only because the troll community considers us on the outside of their community. So thanks for grinding like you do. There are a lot of tweets that I actually want to call out, because I think you've added so much to the community over the course of time, but I'll certainly focus on the more recent ones. Today on this CPI number, I'll just let you go off on it the way that you would.
This was really, really a big source of relief. There are a lot of people who are closet transitorians, and they were happy today. They're starting to see, basically, they're like, yay, the Fed has talked us into a recession, and we put so much fiscal impulse into the economy that now people have run out of money. This is fantastic. We're finally going to get inflation to come down. I mean, was this really the goal, people? But look, the skews were obvious. Used cars coming down. They're coming down hard. Look at CarMax's earnings. I'm happy that a few weeks ago for Quill's clients, we put out a car manufacturer and especially retailer sell signal. That's worked out really well. But understand that used cars are going to come through. Goods inflation is going to come through. Goods deflation is going to come through. Disinflation is going to come through with a huge lag. But yeah, there's always stocks that can tell you what's to come.
Yeah, what's interesting.
And CarMax is, by the way, a Wall Street darling. So it's interesting to see this one finally go.
Yeah, we talked about the Manheim yesterday, but just so that everyone can see it on slide 92, these are the year-over-year comparisons. So this was actually, the Manheim index itself had been slowing, as you know, but for it to start slowing already without having to lap the big, big comps, which are on the come, I mean, that puts the icing on that cake. That one to me, you know, now that'll be everyone's, you know, talking point now that you and I just you know, focus the mind on it. The big obvious one to me is got to be oil. I mean, if you look at where oil is today and you look at the base effects looking forward, is there anybody who can make a call for not disinflation? And I don't mean like next month's number. I mean on a trending quarterly basis going from peak inflation somewhere to downward sloping.
No, I think that's a really difficult case to make. And, you know, you're actually, it's a slow moving phenomenon, but you are seeing rig counts come up and it's kind of inevitable. And they held out for so long in the Permian down here in the part of the world where I am, but they're finally ticking up. So you will see more supply come online. We know that Iran's been quietly supplying the world. We know that Russia is going to manage to get its oil out of its country. So look, the confluence of factors, the base effects, what the hell ever is happening in China that's going to affect global demand for oil, the obvious industrial recession that's taken hold here in the United States, and by the way, is bleeding to your home country. We've been writing a lot about Canada lately. These are all things that are medium term, not beneficial to oil prices.
Yeah, I mean, the fundamental, that was a tight wrap up on that. I mean, the fundamental reality is that you'd have to have almost like a whole other litany of things go the other way on what you just said. I mean, to get oil's price, slide 75, guys, just on the math, to get it to be an inflationary number, in other words, a number that's higher sequentially, you'd have to have $144 as the average per barrel in the coming quarter, and then obviously a lot higher than that by this time next year. Do you get the sense that people, I know everybody talks about base effects now, but if you were to talk to, you know, just take a sample, certainly don't use Twitter, but I mean a sample of people that are paying for Quill, like institutional investors, I'll just tell you what my answer is. I almost shock people with this chart when I tell them what the average is. Do you think that people know what the hurdle is to get inflation from here?
Look, what I think people do is extrapolate way too much from what has just happened.
Right.
And they're like, well, Putin's not stepping back. And I'm like, that's irrelevant. You have to look at the aggregate of all of the factors that are inputting. I think a lot of my clients do understand what's going on, and they're really skeptical of Goldman Sachs making billions of dollars on its commodities desk and calling for a commodity super cycle. And I'm like, that's because China's economy is accelerating and they're about to go on another building boom. Help me out here, because that's where all of the theories fall flat. And you know what? These banks, this massive rush into commodities, this is classic late cycle behavior and talking up your book. While, by the way, the house is likely selling in the other direction.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like, you know, like I think it was Curry today. It's not like anybody for real is going to be betting permanently with his one-way view here. This is not how you trade commodities. Let's go to what the Fed's going to do with that. Because you have the levels, right? We'll show our now cast for inflation. Now it's almost a lock because this inflates the Q1 number because it's a March number with an 8 in front of it. But if you look at slide 15, just downward sloping inflation. Do they care? Let's just say that my numbers are right.
Canada Dry, Keith. Canada Dry, right here. Anyways.
Like, does it matter? Like at 7 going to 6.5 going to 5.5 inflation, does it matter to the Fed? Like, are they going to back off or no?
Okay, they're phasing in quantitative tightening, A. They've only done 25 basis points, B. I think the reason that they're doing a phase in for QT, I think the March 4th 50 basis point bomb is coming, but I think the reason that they're phasing in QT is they're so paranoid about what's going to happen to the headline. And if the headline doesn't give, they're going to be pressured to keep tightening. And I think that's what people have to understand. It's not that the transitory narrative is not finally starting to come into Jay Powell's court. Mm-hmm. It's that midterm elections are going to keep his ass to the fire, forcing him to tighten when he wants to stop tightening.
Right.
So I think the real lever going forward is going to be, especially as we see this massive steepening. But I think that the Fed is going to be forced to continue to go further than they will because we're 7 months outside of an election.
I mean, that to me, I could see that now, but, you know, NASDAQ down 25-30%, Bitcoin like at 30,000 instead of 40,000. I don't think Bitcoin comes into
that.
But credit markets on fire, you know, the whole thing fully loaded. I mean, at this, guys, show the chart on corporate spreads that we talked about, with Green. This is like last time corporate spreads got into this spot. We're not quite there yet. I mean, he turned very quickly in December. It's actually interesting. The 10-year yield today is where it was in December of 2018. See where that little pointy spot? There's a little. It took a cup of coffee in December of 2018 there, where we got to what we call the policy angst line. Are you saying that this time he won't be able to act on that? What's happening in corporate credit? You've been super negative. You've been one of the best critics, I think, in terms of articulating and simplifying, you know, how big this debt bomb of a bubble is. And that would imply that if he doesn't back off, then you're going to blow up corporate credit junk fully loaded.
You are, because compared to the last, look, February 19, 2020, we crossed $10 trillion outstanding U.S. corporate debt. Now we're pushing 12.
Yeah.
And you've got the likes of AT&T doing $25-30 billion deals in one day. You haven't even shut junk bond down. I don't know if you've got the move index in any of your slides, but we're 10 points shy as of yesterday's close on the move index, which precedes the VIX, by the way, of the post-pandemic peak.
Mm-hmm.
which sorry of the post taper peak. The post taper peak of 140 was higher than the post pandemic peak of 139 on the move alone.
Yep.
And that tells you that you've got credit risk bubbling up in the system. But my thesis is that I think Powell's going to let something break.
Really?
I don't think he's going to let everything break, but I think he has been, I think he's going to try and save the Treasury market with some of these new facilities, new backstops that he's got, and let some credit go.
Really?
I didn't see triple B.
If you're right on it, I mean, like I say this to institutional clients all the time, I'm like, look, if I'm wrong, because I expect Powell to back off, but I always say if I'm wrong, I'm going to make more money on the short side. And that's, so I don't really care if I'm right or wrong. I just want to make money, as Mike Taylor was reminding people of yesterday.
Hell yes. Look, Powell knows he did something really wrong. Powell knows that he built more stagnation into the system that now he's having to clean up inside of a four-year period.
Okay.
This isn't like what Janet and Ben left him. This isn't their leftovers. This is something that he created because he backstopped triple Bs mm-hmm. when he was bailing out the world on March 23rd, 2020. So my argument is because inflation is as high as it is and he can hide behind that, and politicians are going to make sure that he hides behind the headline CPI. I get that the core is going to start to roll down. But because he can hide behind that, I argue that he's going to let some of the worst of these credits go. He has to break the back of the housing market. He can't do that. He can't make investors blink. Because investors' bread and butter is credit. The people fueling residential real estate are the same people who have the most risk to corporate credit. They're the LBO private equity guys. There's hundreds of billions of dollars of private equity earmarked for residential real estate because they don't have anything. I was going to say a really bad word. They don't have anything to buy on the commercial real estate side. So they keep trying to pour and pour more into residential real estate. He wants to break their back. He can't do that. Until they have to harvest gains somewhere else.
That's interesting. Do you guys, what is the pushback? Because you know you're widely known as a Fed insider, obviously. So when you say it, it sounds different, and it is different than when I say it. When I'm saying stuff, it's just what I think, which is completely different than all the plugins that you have. What do people say back to that? I can tell you what our clients would say to me if I said that. I mean, do they're like bullshit? The Fed's got to put. They've always had to put her. They're like, oh, okay, I hear you.
Everybody on my Twitter feed. I drop bombs, don't tell anybody, but every once in a while, I just to see what happens. And it's so consistent. The Fed's going to backstop. The Fed's going to backstop. The Fed's going to backstop. I mean, that is everybody's working assumption. By the way, everybody in the industry that we've been in, nobody was around when Volcker was around. I'm not trying to say that Jay Powell was Paul Volcker at all. Hell no. If he was, something else would have happened good a long time ago. But I'm trying to say that he understands the optics of this. You and I go back and forth on this one thing. He's worth north of $100 million. Keith, why didn't he just go play golf? Why didn't he just go back to private equity? Why stay?
I think that's crazy. I mean, I've thought about that a lot, actually. Too many thoughts for one person in my mind. It's like, what are you doing? Like, why would you? Why? What is the answer to that?
Unless he wants, remember, Ben Bernanke, got out of office and said, I renounce the fact that I was ever a Republican. And he became a Democrat. That ain't happening with Jay Powell. It's not. And I don't think he cottons to the idea of Fed liabilities being hijacked to be legal tender for the Treasury Department. So I think that he actually wants to prevent socialism from coming alive in America, which you kind of have to do from a position of leadership inside the Fed. Mm. So if you want Armageddon to happen, if you want central clearing of treasuries, go back, read the Group of 30 paper that was pretty much authored by Timothy Geithner. Remember that name? Bill Dudley probably had a say in it, who, by the way, is to me the most active Fed official in the universe right now is Bill Dudley. He's got the biggest voice. And I'm not confused and I'm not senile. But go back and look at central clearing of treasuries. If you can get that, which Jamie Dimon would go kicking and screaming, you'd have to get it past the bank lobbyists through Congress. You would bypass the ability of the biggest banks to hold the treasury market hostage. Mm. But you'd have to have an emergency to go there. Mm. And one of my theories about Jay Powell is he actually wants to try and save the U.S. Treasury as opposed to let it get hijacked by the progressives.
That's interesting.
One reason for him to be there, that's it.
That's So you're saying that the chances of MMT fall, or you know, or they would have been higher if you had Lyle Brainard in the seat, because it's not Jay Powell, and she would have combined forces with the progressive side, and voila, you'd have MMT ahead of the midterms, and now you can't because he's there? Is that what you're saying?
I don't think it's an ahead of the midterms thing. I think the risk is after the midterms, if there's an economic calamity, that the Republicans are like, uncle, I'll vote anything you want. And it's actually the Republicans voting in MMT, because people do anything when they're looking at the 2024 presidential election. I'm not talking about nothing's happening before the midterms. No, the Republicans are having way too much fun watching Warren implode. No, nothing's happening before the midterms. Nada. So I'm talking about the risk is after, and I think Jay Powell knows it.
So what do you think that there's anything about the rub that he felt, obviously, with her poo-pooing his nomination? Do you think that that's going to be something that ends in them working together, or absolutely not?
Meh. She didn't vote for him the first time on the Senate Banking Committee when he was first confirmed. Hmm. She didn't vote for him again. She was the sole holdout. Again, who cares?
So you think she's a nothing burger?
Warren?
Do you think she's like a nothing burger? Like, do you think they're this whole idea that they can hold hands and save markets again together?
All right, Keith, I got a question for you. Is there a head of the FDIC? OCC? Bank Supervision and Regulation? Are any of these vacancies filled in Washington, D.C.? No.
No.
Not a single one. Not a single one. And everybody that Biden nominates gets kicked out by Joe Manchin and Pat Toomey. It's the Manchin-Toomey Club. So you can talk a big game. You can say that Warren's dangerous, but she doesn't have any lieutenants in positions of leadership to carry any of this crazy shit out.
Wow. Okay, so let's play this through. So we get quad, let's say that I'm right, and quad four hits in all of its, it's actually a really sad
thing. Now that I'm reading you, I'm starting to understand all this quad stuff.
Okay. Quad stuff. Quad four is when you get, in this case, and they're all different, I mean, this vintage of quad four, is when you get a disinflation of the prior peak inflation, which you and I seemingly agree at this point of the conversation, and you get a real growth slowdown, which is largely a function of the base effects, but also of demand destruction, like you just said, that the Fed is seemingly and willingly engaging in through the lens of the housing market. The housing data is nasty. So let's just say we get to that point. On my clock, that's Q2. From a corporate earnings perspective and a corporate credit risk perspective, that Q2, of course, will be reported right on the screws ahead of the midterms, so because it'll be reported in Q3. So that picture, I'm just take the argument that actually plays out. You're saying that would not be a spot where Powell will budge or be forced to budge politically. Is that what you're saying?
I mean, you'd have to have passive flows give way. Really, you'd have to have something that made the stock market go down so much. You'd have to have such a complete collapse in credit that something triggered the potential for systemic risk. And that would definitely pull Powell off the sidelines and make him a hell of a lot less hawkish, because he's not going to let systemic risk come undone on his watch. No sane person would. But you'd have to have something really bad go happen quickly.
How would he, guys, if you can show today, which interesting today, maybe not surprising given the macro tourism associated with the CPI, like everybody on every channel has got an opinion on this, which is nonsense. But again, it's rear view looking, as you know. But still, forward rate hike expectations this morning were at the highest level that they've been of the cycle at almost 8.94. So when we write it down every day, it's like, okay, today 8.94, the two-year yield. Actually, right as the number was reported, the two-year yield finally stopped going up, and that's a pretty good proxy for that. My question is, would Powell, be, I think he uses the word nimble, would he be nimble enough to walk back one, two, or three rate hikes from 9, and would that be enough? First of all, do you think he'd do that?
I think he wants flexibility to live with the balance sheet. His idea of neutral was always higher. He's never liked the zero bound. So I would like to think that he would try and use the lever of the balance sheet, because they're talking about making the balance sheet runoff so much more aggressive than it was before. But again, Keith, we're having a we're having a 7-8 month discussion here. Mm-hmm. We really are. And it's again, it's, you're going to have to see how violently markets react. And right now you're up 300, you're down 400. It's, the volatility is so high and the move is so high that you could start to see things break in credit sooner. Remember, February we had one bankruptcy, $50 million or more in liabilities on your Bloomberg bankruptcy tracker. One. March we had nine. Let's see what April brings. Hell, let's see what May brings, because April is your happy-go-lucky, friendly, technically happy, seasonally happy. Everything's happy in April. Let's see what May brings.
Yeah, that's a really good point. By the way, slide 47, she's mentioned it more than a few times. And we're showing a spread relationship, which is equally relevant. But again, showing the move minus the VIX. This is on, like Omicron. So again, the divergences, and you know, whether or not the market's right or wrong, I tend to go with the market being right, is one question. But a different slide I want to ask you a question on, because this is maybe more your bag than most people's, on slide 51. How much does the Fed pay attention to the shadow rate, and does it matter?
The Fed will tell you that it does not pay attention to the shadow rate. And the way they do pay attention to the shadow rate is by querying by the New York Fed Markets Desk using the survey. Okay. And that's how they pay attention. They pay attention to the street. And I'm not trying to say that they're kowtowing to the stock market, which they do. Don't get me wrong. But when it comes to setting levels of monthly quantitative tightening, when it comes to what the neutral rate is, they really do listen to the primary dealer community that's surveyed by the New York Fed. It's a massive, it's a massive operational flaw.
Mm. So it's like a groupthink, consensus taking exercise.
That's how we got the original taper. That's how we got that. I mean. That was what made Jay Powell so much of a maverick when he first started. Mm-hmm. It was because the street was telling him 3% neutral is going to break something, and he kept saying, I want my 3%. Because mm-hmm. he was thinking independently before he got slapped. Mm-hmm. Something slapped. So it's very hard to think independently, because the street will hurt you if you're the Fed. And again, I go back to, why the hell is Jay Powell sticking around unless he wants to declaw the street? Mm-hmm. And declaw the street by centrally clearing treasuries.
Well, I mean, that's another question on this is QT. Like, do you agree with the premise that is the shadow rate, which is, again, it's just a new way to think about it because we did new things. For people that don't know, it's basically taking the upside down of what just happened. So if you're going to buy them and buy them and buy them, and then you stop buying them, that's one rate hike or set of rate hikes. And then if you start to actually sell them, you know, then we get the full-blown QT. Do you agree that that's, at least conceptually, shadow rate or not, do you think that that's the right way to think about the rate of change?
I'm a data purist. I don't need to agree with anything. What I can see is other deposits, liabilities on the H8 that comes out every Friday afternoon after the close in the Fed's data. And that tells you that that growth rate since December the 15th has flatlined, come from a very robust number to a flatline. That tells you that liquidity going into the system since the taper began on December the 15th has come down now post-taper to a flatline. Mm-hmm. Meaning, if you start to shrink that balance sheet, it's going negative.
Right.
So for everybody on my Twitter feed, it's like, money supply. And I'm like, no, it's the delta. Mm-hmm. And when your delta is about to turn negative, that means that there is a multiplier effect of taking money out of the system. And that I'm answering your question by framing it differently.
Yeah, I think we're saying it's all about the rate of change. It's all about the delta. And you cannot say that it helped and not say that it, and at the same time say it's not going to hurt by reversing the prior action. So
Google 2017, $2.1 trillion global quantitative easing, and then Google 2018, the hangover.
Yeah, it's how about here's another chart I want to get your response to on the euro. If you slide 50, guys, on the curve, 3 month euro dollar curve. I mean, it basically says we're you know, peaking in June. So whether or not he's nimble or not, I mean, the what the market actually expects, not looking at short-term, like two-year notes or anything like that, or what I just showed on rate hikes, if you actually look at the three-month euro-dollar curve, we're not that far away from, you know, right on time is what I'd say, heading into quad four, is that the market's rate of change, rate hikes peak is in June. What do you think about that?
Look, I follow a guy by the name of Ben Herzon at Macroeconomic Advisors. I think his GDP model is the most real time and the most accurate on the street. He used to be Macroeconomic Advisors, then he was IHS Market, now consolidation's alive and well, S&P Global, whatever. He's at 0.4% GDP Q1, and he's already starting to take down Q2 to 2% based on more inventory being in the system than anybody's talking about or wants to acknowledge, because it's a supply chain disruption. Right now, you're talking about rounding errors between effective contraction and expansion in the U.S. economy.
Mm-hmm. Well, that, I mean, I'd agree.
Your timing is spot on. Yeah. And good spending is happening at such a fast pace that you cannot not pay attention to what's happening, especially in the confidence numbers. The New York Fed has a survey that's been coming out for 9 years. People's income expectations are the lowest in 9 years of data keeping as of yesterday's data.
Yep.
Small businesses this morning, their expectations, lowest on records. By the way, they go back a hell of a lot longer than 9 years, even though they don't say right now that sales are an issue, because that's a lagging indicator along with the unemployment rate. So if you want to watch the unemployment rate, fine. Try driving through your rearview mirror.
Yeah, the most important number this week is actually for me not. I think I didn't take that as a shot that our nowcast isn't as accurate as aforementioned person. But on slide 14, guys, we're at 0.73. So again, you go from 7% GDP headline to zero something. Let's call it a wash between me and the other guy. But again, the retail sales number is going to really matter on Thursday, I believe it's released. And that's because that's, you know, in terms of when you think about the marginal impact on the model, slide 16, we show the features in our model and what has the heaviest weights. Retail sales is obviously one of the heaviest weights. So that part of it, I wondered in terms of feedback, because you do trigger people on Twitter like big time, and I love it. The people, you've always done it for the people. You know, most, you know, whether you're good at this or you're bad at this, not many people on Wall Street will stand up for, you know, the good people of Canada and Texas at the same time and everything in between and say, hey, look, you guys are getting a raw deal here, and look at, you know, real incomes today, or you could look at average earnings or real retail sales. Is that something that you're expecting to see deteriorate at a faster pace, X the base effects, just given what's happened or not?
I think you've got a lot of things going on here. And if the God help me, I'm going to blame this on my buddy, Brent Donnelly. So Brent Donnelly, who was on the sell side forever, but now he's at Spectrum Markets and he's got the best little daily. Brent Donnelly is like, look, Danielle, people forget what happened in 1999 and 2000. Mm-hmm. There was this bizarre or just strange tick down in the NASDAQ. It was called paying taxes, retail investors paying taxes. Look what's happening in crypto right now as we approach April 17th. Okay, so tax refunds have come and gone. Your essential spending is higher than it's ever been. Food, housing, energy, even though the month over month is coming off, even though it doesn't hurt as much. There's a war going on, by the way. There's a shit show in Washington and nobody can get anything done on your behalf, nor are they even trying. And your income's down. And there's nothing behind it. There's no child tax credit. Income tax refund season is over. What are you going to do? You're going to stop spending. Mm-hmm. I've been talking to a guy named Craig Fuller, FreightWaves. And the data that he follows shows that spending hit a wall on March 8th. Mm-hmm. Now, people who need their income tax refunds, they get them in February. And they spend them quickly, or they pay down credit card debt. We've seen Bank of America's real-time credit card spending hit a wall in mid-March. I don't believe in coincidences at all. Hmm. So something is happening to the U.S. consumer. And without, and by the way, confidence is declining quickest for those who make $100,000 or more. Because even though they're not down 30% in their stock portfolio, they're very uncomfortable with how violent. You can't even call it volatile anymore, how violent their portfolios are behaving. So that top quintile represents 40% of U.S. spending and more for discretionary goods. So yeah, do I think retail sales are really important? Yes, I do. Do I think something happened in mid-March? Yes, I do, mm-hmm. which was a month ago.
Well, if you look at, you know, how people make money, guys on slide 39, and this was a component that tourists will talk about today on the, you know, if you look at, again, this is looking at real average hourly earnings, which not everyone looks at things in rate of change or on a real basis, but Danielle and I both do. That's what happened. It's real. You know, that's, I don't think it's very complicated. It's not news of this morning either. You know, is there any other reason for somebody to believe that that's going to magically go up? I guess the one talking point people would say, Danielle, back at you, is that there is a lot of pent-up demand because we're still rolling out of Omicron and savings in America are massive.
Okay. I refuted that a few days ago in a feather, by the mm-hmm. way. Savings on a dollar level are below where they were in January of 2020. Mm-hmm. So, because I put out that the saving rate was lower, and like, no, you can't look at the saving rate. You have to look at how much money's just sitting there. All right, I'll give you that several corporations have a hell of a lot of cash. And your oldest demographic and your wealthiest demographic, yeah, they're sitting on a lot of cash still. But in the aggregate, savings are lower than they were in January 2020. All of that stimulus money has come and gone and been spent, and then some, given what we know has happened in credit card spending. So sorry.
No, that's good. I mean, I'm just throwing back what people throw back at me to see if the ball comes back. So thank you for doing that.
It's just data.
I mean,
nobody should be offended by data.
And by the way, if you're not reading her Daily Feathers, that's what you call them, right? The Daily Feathers?
Daily Feather.
Yeah. Those are great.
We published on Canada today. We said that recession probability is way underpriced and that Canada cannot replace Russia overnight.
Is there something that you wanted to say about any of that, like the Russians, the Chinese, anything on the patriotic American capitalism front? You know, we have not gone there, and before I go to the queue, I wanted to ask you that. The world is seemingly a little bit more volatile in terms of triggering people each and every week or day, for that matter. You got anything to say about that?
Well, I mean, I'm kind of shocked that there was any kind of divisiveness in America regarding who we know to be our enemies and who we don't know to be our enemies. So there should have never been a question there. I think that what we should be doing now is looking on a deeper level at shame on us, mm-hmm. because China was able to bail out the global economy when it went into an industrial recession in 2015 and 2016 by spending enough money to bail out Latin America, Africa, Europe, United States. They're not doing that this time. If you hadn't noticed over the weekend, there's a little bit of turmoil in China, to say nothing of what's going on in Russia. These people are not our friends. And if we didn't take the episode of the pandemic to understand that we need to have essentials and items of national security covered here, or at least with our allies, then God help us. And I think the best thing that's come out of this is that we've seen a more unified Europe than what we had going in. Mm-hmm. So there are things in this world that are more important than, gee, Germany exports more to China starting 2021 than it had in 2020, when the United States was still the largest export market. So there are indeed things that are more important. But, you know, all of this, this whole energy thing, not building pipelines. I mean, Canada's got the oil, can't get it to us. This is bullshit. I mean, if we don't have some serious come to Jesus and get past all this. I hug trees. I do. I've got a garden out back. It's not that I'm anti-environmental. It's that I'm pro-American. Mm-hmm. And we know who our allies are, and we should ensure that we have an energy policy that embraces our allies and makes sure that we can give the middle finger to our enemies. And we're not there.
No, we're not even close. Kyle Bass did a great job walking through at least one man's view of that, and that's one woman's view of it as well. And it's good to get, you know, American patriots, like, to talk, you know, plainly about that. I mean, like, when you think about, you know, what's become of Wall Street or all these officialdoms and institutions and us giving all this, you know, airtime to the bloody Federal Reserve. I mean, who the hell asked for that? You know, I certainly didn't. I mean, I'm not even American. That's for one. But again, to centrally plan and command markets, that's not something, yeah, I was looking for. So I do appreciate, and I want to get to the queue, that you do think that this time could be different in that regard with Powell, that he's not going to do what he did before. And that, to a lot of people, to me, that's a good thing. You know, because I'm going to make money on it, but also because it at least shows you that some parts of the market can fail on its own frailties.
And you have to get there, Keith. I mean, what's the alternative? And okay, fine. If headline inflation is forcing him to be a man, fine. So be it. Go there. Because sometimes it helps if you get rid of the optionality. Because since Alan Greenspan stepped into office, there's been a hell of a lot of optionality at the Fed, because generally speaking, interest rates were headed down and inflation was benign. Mm-hmm. So that optionality is out the window. So if that forces hard decisions, people being an adult inside the Eccles building, then so be it. Finally.
Yeah, I mean, it'll be really interesting to see what the bid-ask spread is on the adult price of high-yield spreads
or the S&P 500. Look, he got Brainard and Williams to come in line. He showed you proof in the last week that he could get the two biggest doves, the vice chairman of the FOMC and the vice chair of the Federal Reserve Board, if he ever gets confirmed, but he showed you that he could bring his top two lieutenants, the most dovish two people, in line. That holy trinity is the power seat: vice chair FOMC, vice chair Federal Reserve Board, chair Federal Reserve Board. Mm-hmm. He could have dissents up his wazoo if he's got those three in line.
I love that. I love the way you talk. I love the way you talk to me. All right, let's get into these questions. The first question is actually from Italy. This is great. Lara from Tuscany, Italy. I'd love to be there sometime soon. Danielle, how many more Fed hikes aside from the May 50 basis points do you actually expect? And will they start to do outright Treasury sells versus their current posturing for a moderate balance sheet runoff?
So I think I think that as long as nothing breaks in credit, that you'll see consecutive 50 basis points hikes. But again, there's a gigantic caveat in there. As long as nothing breaks in credit, and we're seeing credit start to crack again, you can follow the MOVE Index for free. Pull it up, keep it up, bookmark it. As far as selling things, man, if they're going to sell, I don't think that they're going to write a campaign ad before the midterms. So I think if there's actual sells going on, even though there's a bunch of accounting maneuvers that suggest that the Fed never, ever has to book a loss, but people who watch the Fed closely, and I'm not talking about myself, I'm not going to be going, oh, look, the Fed's insolvent. But the people who follow the Fed in the middle of the night, they'll go crazy. And you'll end up with this campaign ad for somebody running in the midterms about the Central Bank of America being insolvent. And that's what happens if, when mortgage rates are north of 5%, you go into the market and sell something that you bought at 2. So it doesn't work to sell anything soon. And that's why they're so focused on treasury bills, on allowing roll-off, which is very short-term paper. They have said that they're considering selling mortgage-backed securities. But boy, I can tell you, there's a lot of things in this world that they'd rather do first than get a root canal and visit the proctologist on the same day. Because that's what booking losses is for all the conspiracy theorists in the middle of the night on my Twitter feed.
For a 47-year-old man, that could actually happen to me if I don't schedule it properly. And I don't want that. That's bad. That'd be bad. Nobody wants that. And by the way, I think it'd be really bad. I think if you're right and you do back-to-back.
You did it virtually, by the way, Keith.
Yeah. I still think, and some people think I'm bananas on this, I think that they're done if that's the case. Done raising interest rates. I don't think the market will bear 2 back-to-back 50 basis point hikes. I think it's going to be a far stretch for them to get beyond the May 50 basis points without markets collapsing further from where they already have. This is a nonlinear markets. We just went through with Buddy Carter, who did it eloquently. I mean, who the hell told these people that they're going to be able to have a linear schedule of rate hikes and a linear reaction by capital markets? That's the fucking stupidest thing I've ever heard of so far, or at least the dumbest thing that's come out of my own mouth so far.
Yeah, look. The world ended yesterday and nobody stopped to pay attention when the 10s, 30s inverted. For God's sake.
Yeah.
They just don't have that much room. Not when markets are giving them these unmitigated signals. look, there's just too much leverage in the system. There's $1 trillion of non-financial debt that has to be refinanced globally in 2022. Just this year. If anybody has not paid attention, countries are falling, like entire countries.
Yeah.
Sri Lanka has announced it is going to default.
Sri Lanka. This morning, that's the first thing I wrote down in my notebook this morning. Sri Lankan rubies. Things are collapsing. Shit's hitting the fan. It's bad.
Peru's a mess. Pakistan. It's just a mess. Mm. And it's going to continue to be a mess if the dollar gets much stronger.
So dollar's been my biggest position this year, and it's been great. I love America, and I love the U.S. dollar.
We went in bullish on the year.
Yeah, I only love it when we're in quad four, by the way. That's the only time I fall in love, and I'm promiscuous when it comes to that. So it'll eventually go away as a long-term holding. But, you know, during quad four, it's great. But long-term bonds, buying long-term bonds is probably the number one question I get all the time. It's the thing that triggers people. You know, people are long treasuries, and they're waiting and waiting and waiting. And they hear a discussion like this, and they hear that this could be kaput for the Fed, you know, in trying to get through this whole thing. People, you know, that's one big asset class that, to your point, with the move index at 130, 140, it's not going to work. But it could work big time from here. This question from Sarah from Rio de Janeiro, I love the fact that our top two questions are from not America. We have a nice global audience here. Sarah from Rio de Janeiro says, would you be actually a buyer of long-dated bonds at 3%, and could it be as early as this month?
Yes.
Yes. Good. You should be on the macro show, because that just wasted no time. All right. Thank you very much. we always have a, I don't know if you knew this, but we have an up, just like we do now. You can vote questions up and you can vote them down. And literally every morning for the last 2 weeks, the number one question is something about the end of, you know, people taking on way too much leverage in terms of their TLT or whatever position, obviously not risk managing it properly. But that's definitely a question that people want a simple answer to, so thank you for that. All right, this next question, it's moving up in the queue pretty good. With the sudden increase in mortgage rates, do you see home prices coming down in the coming months? If so, will the Fed reverse course on MBS, mortgage-backed securities, rolling off?
Well, first of all, mortgage-backed securities would have to be really, would have to pull quite a miracle to roll anywhere, because prepayment has collapsed. So the idea of MBS roll-off is false. And that's why they confronted it head on by saying, if need be, in our quest to get to be a pure player in the Treasury market, and just in terms of refinancing and holding the balance sheets static, we're going to get out of the MBS business. They'd have to sell. I do think that there are signs of breakage in housing right now. Redfin actually came out with some good data that showed that once there was the FHFA fee that was slapped on top of it, second home purchases, on top of the increase that we've seen in mortgage rates, that you've seen a collapse in second home purchases. And you have to bear in mind, who is the marginal buyer of residential real estate? Currently, that marginal buyer is really wealthy people, and they're second guessing, and investors.
Yeah, I mean, that's slide 35, guys. You can see, like, once you get into this this level of mortgage rates, it absolutely matters. I mean, the Federal Reserve knows this. This affordability drops like a hammer. I mean, this thing is not going anywhere but down in terms of demand. That was a great data point to call out as of this morning, using my Canadian accent, if you do not mind.
I'm going to interject on this. I'm going to show you what asinine looks like real quick. So my favorite person on Twitter, who has to remain anonymous, shared with me an anecdote that somebody who had an FHA loan at 3.5% mortgage refinanced into 5.25% to pull some cash equity out of the home. The marginal increase on that debt that was taken on was a rate of 22%.
Ah! I mean, it's because people are broke. 50%, what is it, 50% of Americans have $500 or less?
And you asked earlier, what are consumers going to do? Because talk about that savings cushion. That savings cushion's gone. Cash out refinancings are gone. 3% of mortgages in America are able to be refinanced economically. 3%.
Yeah, this is, I mean, it's interesting. The breaking points of bond yields and rates of capital or cost of capital, really good topic. A question from Gavin, who's real popular in Hedgeye Nation. I have my own answer to this. I want to get yours first. How high do you think Treasury yields can go before they become a problem for the Fed and the Treasury? You already talked about the part of that, but.
I'm not trying to be trite. I think they're problematic.
Already?
I think Treasury rates are already problematic. I do.
Yeah.
You've had entire office buildings, apartment buildings trading at 2% cap rates.
Yeah.
Pretty problematic. The level of sensitivity is unlike anything we've ever seen. Again, even when it comes to when Treasuries become damaging to the system, it's still all about starting places in the delta.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's part of my answer to this question, slide 44, is you just go back to the prior cycle high in the Fed funds rate. And you've never been able to eclipse that, Daniel. So I wonder if that, because again, that's where people own things. That's where the leverage problems start to occur if you eclipse some of these things. You and I have the same answer. Like, for it to hold above like 2.6 on the 10-year for any sustained period of time would make it different this time on that front. What do you think about that?
I think it would. And you're giving either the Fed or the resiliency of the U.S. economy too much credit.
Right.
To operate under that premise. You're saying miraculously U.S. households are going to pull something out of their ass that's going to help them keep going. Or people are going to believe the Fed and the Fed's not going to break anything. Neither one really holds water to me.
I agree with you. I mean, that's why I think the conditions, I mean, first of all, the Nasdaq's already crashed this year. If you go back to its closing low of the year, it's down 22% from its quad two cycle peak on November the 19th. The Russell's already crashed as well. We're just, you know, playing a game of chicken. Bitcoin's down over 40% from November the 8th. You know, is this the most obvious train wreck that you've seen in a long time or ever for capital markets?
I would have to say that given most of my career entailed one really long cycle followed by another even longer cycle.
Mm-hmm.
So seeing this cycle play out inside of 2-3 years is remarkable. So everything that you've learned how to pick out of macro data in the most nuanced fashion is like, whoop, hitting you in the face because it's happening so fast.
Yeah.
So you don't have to be a rocket science. You don't have to have your PhD. You don't even have to be a market veteran, even though being market veteran is very helpful because the signposts are happening so quickly.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have the University of Michigan's Richard Curtin, who's only been there for 50 years, come out and say, as long as I've been here, I've never seen people's expectations for their income be so low. And I'm like, oh, well, shit, he's only been there a half century.
Well, shit.
I mean, there are certain things that are not really, you know, that's not a subtle sign. And, you know, again, what's happening in this, people don't appreciate the import on GDP math and on corporate margins of carrying inventory. When they're, look, we've gone from just in time to just in case, which is the biggest cliche in the world, even though I was one of the first to write about it. But that's what we've done. Operations managers don't know how to cover inventory costs, and inventory costs are at the highest on record. Warehousing prices are at the highest on record because you have all of these companies that have segued from just in time to just in case. And if you think that carrying interest is free, you're wrong. And if you think that carrying inventory is problematic when demand is slowing down, you're an idiot.
And guess what? We're out of time, and she has no problem calling anybody in officialdom an idiot. I sincerely thank you for that because, you know, in many ways, I deserve to be called an idiot, and I do get called an idiot quite a bit. But, you know, this could be the most idiotic.
I hate you.
This could be the most idiotic policy mistake I've ever seen, and we've seen a lot together. But thanks for making the time. I know everybody is quite thankful for your time on Hedgeye TV.
And thank you for your time recently, Keith, in New York, and I'll see you in May.
Oh, that is that was fun. That was fun. She's Danielle DiMartino Booth. She was so kind enough. She's the only person that actually wanted to sit down with me and hear about me as a human being. I'm gonna love this woman for the rest of my life. All right, coming up next, Jim Chanos and I aren't lovers. Here we are, Jim Chanos coming up next.
Thanks for listening to Real Conversations, brought to you by Hedgeye. Don't forget to check out Hedgeye.com to get more actionable investing insights from our team of more than 40 research analysts. And check us out on Twitter at our handle, @Hedgeye. This presentation is informational only. None of the information contained herein constitutes an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any security or investment vehicle, nor does it constitute investment recommendation or legal, tax, accounting, or investment advice by Hedgeye or any of its employees, officers, agents, or guests. This information is presented without regard for individual investment preferences or risk parameters and is general, non-tailored, non-specific information. This content is based on information from sources believed to be reliable. Hedgeye is not responsible for errors, inaccuracies, or omissions of information. The opinions and conclusions contained in this report are those of the individual expressing those opinions and conclusions and are intended solely for the use of Hedgeye subscribers and the authorized recipients of the contents. All investments entail a certain degree of risk, and financial instrument prices can fluctuate based on several factors, including those not considered in the preparation of the content. Consult your financial professional before investing. The information contained herein is protected by United States and foreign copyright laws and is intended solely for the use of its authorized recipient. Access must be provided directly by Hedgeye. Redistribution or republication is strictly prohibited. For more detail, please refer to the terms of service at hedgeye.com/terms of service.